Test. Go ahead and keep it bring up to the panel. Wyatt, you're going to need to. There's a little black box on top of the shelf next to you. The one that's further away from you. And hold down the power button. Power button. It's a circle button on the front. All right, does it work now?
Nope. Oh, yay. Thank you. All right. Today I'm going to be speaking on Ecclesiastes 3, 9 through 15. This is the passage that directly follows the famous sort of poem of A Time for Everything. A lot of people will be familiar with that passage. But I think what's really interesting is what follows that that poem. I'll read it right now. The poem itself is, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace." And that's a really famous and sort of covered pretty regularly poem in the book of Ecclesiastes. That's, you know, for everything there's a season, for every a matter under heaven is how that starts. And I think that that provides a good backdrop for what we're going to talk about today. And my title, Not in Vain, I chose that because, and I'll get into this later, but I think there's a pretty significant misunderstanding about the way that vanity is used in the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's a really interesting way to put the book in a different perspective. So the text itself is Ecclesiastes 3, 9 to 15. It's sort of split up into four sections. I'm going to move this. Crunchy. So the way that I would split this up is verse, if you turn in your Bibles, because there's not numbers on here, that's a mistake on my part. Verses 9 and 10 sort of start out presenting a question: what does man gain from his toil? Then verse 11 begins to answer that question and sort of turn the question around. Verse 12 and 13 move into applications. And then verses 14 and 15 look forward to just the praising God and the fear of God. And also there's a lot of connections to the gospel there. So that's sort of what I'm going to talk about. And it says right here, "What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken away from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away." The main speaker went down the wrong pipe. The main speaker in the book of Ecclesiastes is often referred to as the preacher. He is introduced by the author of the book at the beginning and then sort of let out from at the end. But throughout the whole book of Ecclesiastes, we're hearing from a character. And that's sort of an important understanding because in a literary sense, he's an unreliable narrator. He's a pessimist. He has this sort of dark outlook. And he tends to be very depressed. I think that, so that's just sort of a good way to keep in mind. And the main point that I'm going to try to keep coming back to is this. God has given us lives to live for him, and spending them tied up in anything but that is a waste, and truly what is meaningless, because most things that are referred to in the book of Ecclesiastes, as we're about to see, are not meaningless in the sense that we think of it. So Ecclesiastes is set right after Proverbs in the wisdom books, and that's important to notice because Proverbs is full of if-then statements. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it." It's do this, you'll receive this. 28:13, "Whoever conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will obtain mercy." Do this, receive this. Proverbs 19:5, "A false witness will not go unpunished, and he who breathes out lies will not escape." Do this, receive this. Proverbs is full of justice. One thing happens, another thing happens in response. In contrast, Ecclesiastes is about injustice. Ecclesiastes says, yeah, you know, you can live a worthwhile life and that's great and all, but we're all gonna die. And time moves on, you know. Crops grow, crops die, everything stays the same. There's nothing new under the sun. And so there's this contrast between Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, which is, I think, why they're right next to each other. And then the final quote from Proverbs I'll have is, "So you will walk in the way of the good and keep to the paths of the righteous, for the upright will inhabit the land, and those with integrity will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the land, and the treacherous will be rooted out of it." So there's this definite justice in Proverbs. It's very clean cut and light and uplifting, and also sometimes despairing, because there's a standard that's set in Proverbs that's impossible for us to meet in our sinful state. And I think Ecclesiastes takes that view. You know, we can't meet this, so why bother? Or at least that's what it reads like. In the book of Ecclesiastes, there's this word used over and over again, vanity, meaningless, depends on your translation. And the Hebrew there is a word that's, and I'm going to butcher this, hevel. And what it more directly translates to is vapor or smoke. And that's why you hear the phrase in Ecclesiastes repeated, a striving after the wind. And I think that that is where the misconception comes of everything is in vain, everything is vanity. It's not that there is no meaning to all these things that are hevel. They're smoke, they're vapor. There's a meaning there. It's there, we can see it, but we can't grasp it. We in the state we are in, we're chasing after this vapor, and we reach out and we try to take it, and it's just not there because we can't achieve it, we can't understand it in the state that we're in at the moment. And in the context, I'm just going to lead into the passage going through Ecclesiastes 1 and 2. And there are sort of four things that he calls vanity in this passage, these two chapters. The first is wisdom. And he's talking in, it's Ecclesiastes 1, 12 through 18 is the sort of the section that if you want to read over that, I'm going to turn there. 1 through 18, 1, 12 through 18, he says, "I've been king over Jerusalem. I've had all these things. I have understood everything. I've seen everything." He says, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind." It's not meaningless. It's not vanity in the way that we think of it. It's just impossible. We can't understand everything. A pursuit of full understanding and perfect knowledge is impossible to complete. We can't do it. Then he talks about pleasure. And I think that an important distinction here, because he talks a lot, it's the beginning of chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, the vanity of self-indulgence is the sort of subtitle that the ESV editors have decided to put in there. But I think that that's not quite a comprehensive understanding of what he's talking about with self-indulgence. Because, yeah, he talks about this lavish lifestyle and wealth. He also talks about work. Close to the end of the passage, I'm going to find it exactly. He says, "And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil." The reward for anything that we do chasing pleasure on earth is the pleasure itself. There is nothing beyond that. He's saying that, in a sense, this is meaningless. It's vanity. We can't get true joy and pleasure and a full experience of life from just chasing earthly things, self-indulgence. Moving on to verses 2, 12 through 17, just moving through these vanities that he's using to build up to this, to the text, he says, "Why did I pursue wisdom in the first place?" He's thinking about living wisely. And I think that here is really the parallel to Proverbs. He's saying, if I've got all this wisdom, all right, I'm going to apply it. I'm going to live by all that wisdom. And what he finds is, if I live by all these wisdoms that I find in the book of Proverbs, which is previous, but just in general, living wisely, living according to all these rules, I die at the end of it. And people forget me. And I pass on whatever it is that I achieve to somebody else, and they squander it. And if I live foolishly, and I waste my time, and I do stupid things, and I don't pay attention, I die at the end of it. And I pass on whatever I made to somebody, and they squander it. So what's the point? You can't grasp the meaning of what's going on in life just through wisdom. And you can't grasp it through following a set of rules. You can't grasp it through any of these things. And finally, at the end of chapter 2, he turns to toil. And he says, look at all this work I've done. I have all this wisdom. I've done all these things. And then again, my toil results in a thing in this world, and I will die. And I'll pass it on to someone and they will squander it. He says at the very end, oh dear, that's a different audio. He says, what has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. We're looking for meaning. And we can't find it. And I'll go back one moment. In Ecclesiastes, I believe 1:18, there's a line that I find myself, not 1:18, 1:13, I find myself quoting this a lot, is, and I applied my heart to seek out and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. And all of these vanities that I've just talked about following that verse, those are man's unhappy business. And it certainly seems that everything in our lives are a striving after the wind. And I guess I kind of gave spoilers to the answer to the question of, you know, if everything is vanity, what's the point? When I read the passage at the beginning. So let's dig into that. The passage we're in today is a brief respite from the pessimism of the book. You look at all of the vanity, I believe the ESV actually in the outline, since I was looking at that a week or two ago, it lists it as a catalog of vanities or a list of vanities. And it's this deluge of everything's pointless. And you get to verse 3:9, and he sort of starts to change his tone. At several intervals throughout Ecclesiastes, the preacher will take a step back from his complaints and focus on what's not in vain or why he's talking about this or what the purpose is in all this. What's the meaning? Because, as we've said, hevel is that word that's meaningless. Hevel means vapor. Vapor is impossible to grasp. It doesn't mean it's not there. It doesn't mean there isn't meaning. It just means that we can't grasp it. These passages are important because they provide a sense of direction in an otherwise despairing book. So the question, why do we toil? Verse 9, verse 3, verse 9 is starting with, Why? Why, if toil and wisdom and pleasure and foolishness are all hevel, are all chasing after the wind, why do we carry on? And by extension, why can we not grasp the wind we are instructed in the Proverbs to strive after, right? All of these wisdoms, all of these do this, you'll receive that, that we're given, we're told strive after that. And it's in the word of God. We're supposed to live that out. But as we look for it and we strive after it, we can't find it. Why can't we grasp these things? And that's the big question. And the preacher asks a kind of a rhetorical question. What gain has the worker from his toil? Anyone who's been reading Ecclesiastes from chapter one up to this point is going to say nothing. But I think that's the preacher's almost setting up a question for you to expect the answer nothing, and then he's going to subvert your expectations. Here, I think it's just an important semantic note. The worker and his toil, he's not just talking about literal toil. Clearly, this is the worker is anyone, and the toil is all of these things, be they wisdom, toil, foolishness, any of those things that he has said are vain. Anyone living in this world is a subject of this question. And he changes his tone. He says, it's not an unhappy business, it's just business. There's that removal from 1:13 of an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man. He has seen it, and he's claiming to have seen it. He's not saying, what has the worker to gain from the toil? I've seen the business, right? He's not saying that. He's saying, what gain has the worker from his toil? Well, I've seen it. And he's leading into verse 11. And I say that here's where the reason we can't grasp that smoke comes out. Because we are eternal beings. We have souls that will exist in eternity. We will never die, whether we die forever or we live forever. We are eternal. God has created us that way. God isn't eternal. Well, he is eternal, but he's not just eternal. God is infinite. So verse 11 begins to describe that business from verse 10. He answers the question of why, quite simply, by living life and toiling, God will provide us with a more beautiful understanding than we could achieve on the merit of our own wisdom. And life is much better for the living when we trust in him for understanding. That's Greek, so I'm going to say this in English. I've split this up into two different sections. Ecclesiastes 3:11a, he has made everything beautiful in its time. This is a reference back to the poem at the beginning of the chapter, A Time for All Everything, right? And he's saying, God has made everything beautiful in its time. You've just read that, you know, hold on, there's a time for everything, a time for work, a time for play, a time to keep and to cast away, to tear and to sow, right? There's a time for everything. And God is saying, if not God, the preacher is saying, hey, look, if we're going to chase all this wisdom, we're chasing it down outside of its time. We need to let God determine that time because God has set that time. God has made everything beautiful in its time. If something is in its time, that's the time for it. That's a lot of time. And then he moves on. He says, he has put eternity into man's heart. We are beings with eternal souls, eternal spirits. We will last forever. And thus we were created with eternal curiosity. This curiosity is what drives that relentless pursuit of knowledge and power and self-indulgence that we've seen up to this point in the book. And that eternal curiosity is something that a human being can never satisfy. Because while we are eternal, we're limited. And he cannot find out, moving on, what God has done from the beginning to the end. And some view this as a curse, right? He's already said, I spent all my days trying to figure out everything under the sun, everything that God has done, all the work that God has done, and I could not. I learned that this too is vanity. Now, we're created eternally curious and incapable of satisfying. It sounds like a curse. But if we are to live forever with God in heaven as believers, we will exist for eternity. And to not have eternal curiosity, if we're to exist for all of time, would be a curse. Because who wants to get bored in heaven? we're eternal beings. And there's an important difference between eternal and infinite, because God is not just eternal. God is infinite. The illustration I came up with when I was sitting on the couch trying to figure out how to explain the thought that had just popped into my head was it would be like touring the whole world, but you're stuck on one latitude. You can go around in one line, and there's so much more world. There's way more world. You're stuck on one finite line. You're traveling one-dimensionally through a three-dimensional space. You're a line going through a sphere. You can't see everything. If God is infinite, which he is, and we are not infinite, which we are not, then, yeah, we can't understand everything. And it is kind of depressing if we try. And that's where he's answering the question of, well, okay, so why do we toil? He's saying, well, it's definitely not to understand everything, because we can't. We'll exist for eternity, but we won't ever run out of anything to learn. God cannot be fully understood, but the truest moments of his revelation to us come when he chooses them. We can only understand God when he condescends. If God is this infinite being and we are these small, measly human beings, the only time we can understand him is if he takes a step down, comes down to our level. I chose a couple of examples of this. In Judges 6, Gideon is struggling with faith in the Lord. He's saying, I don't know, man. I don't know if you're going to send help and if we're going to beat them. Could you make this sheep fleece wet? And God sort of goes, oh my gosh. Sure. Because God's infinite and Gideon's not. Gideon's kind of a coward. And so God condescends. God does that. He wets the wool. He lets Gideon have that peace of mind because God's so much more than us. We need him to do that. You know, we laugh at Gideon because he's, you know, a coward. And that's sort of the point of his story, is that he's a coward, but God still uses him. We're all that same person. I think about 1 Kings 18, which is the story where Elijah is sort of roped into this competition with the prophets of Baal, and they've got this big altar and they're dancing around it and cutting themselves and beating themselves, trying to get lightning to strike their altar and light a fire. And Elijah walks up to his altar and he prays, and God not only destroys the altar, but he wipes out all of the water that's in this trench around it. And he does this over-the-top display of power. And that's God lowering himself to those priests' level. Because God doesn't need to prove himself to us. God has no need of us. But he chooses to lower himself enough to communicate with us, to have a relationship. And there's sort of that positive end of things with Gideon, where he's giving Gideon assurance. And there's that more heavy-handed instance of the prophets of Baal, who are trying to prove that their God is the superior God. And God says, no, stop. And he uses a very crude form of communication. It's just an explosion. But it gets his point across because, again, he's infinite. We can't understand him. And of course, the prime example of God's condescension to have relationship and communication with man is Christ's coming and his death and his life, and that ministry where God himself comes down. And the fact that an infinite God comes into the form and the existence of a limited being is just another example of how God knows the right time for us to understand something. And, you know, there's all the evidence that we hear about how in human history, Christ came at the perfect time. This is that same verse from Ecclesiastes 3. I need to get back on topic. He has made everything beautiful in its time. God is condescending in the perfect moment and in a perfect way for us to understand and to learn. If we think about like the chariot thrown in Ezekiel, my dad told me this must be like a year or two ago, that the Jewish rabbis never let a student study the chariot thrown alone. You always had to have a more experienced and a more well-versed rabbi with you when you were studying that beginning, that prophecy, that vision in Ezekiel, because it's one of the closest moments we have to God's infinite nature being explained. And we can't understand it. The reason that rabbi was there wasn't so that he could explain it to the guy. It wasn't to correct mistakes. It was to say, hey, stop trying to understand it. There's such a thing as mystery. God is infinite. We cannot understand him. And that's what's important, is we can't get God. If we could, he wouldn't be a very good God. And so we are not infinite, but we are loved by an infinite God. If we try to understand all the things that he has done, we will lead ourselves into despair. But if we let him lead us, allow him to teach us, we will have a great understanding and a more full life. And this all sounds great, but it raises an obvious question. If the best way to get understanding is for God to extend it to us, and we know that we can't earn it, right? If we're doing all the work, we can't do that for understanding, then is the best way to live life really to just sort of sit there and let life happen, and maybe God will come along and give us some understanding? Clearly, that's not the answer. We already know that a pursuit of wisdom is not the way to live life, or at least not the way to dedicate your life to it on your own merit. So sitting back and waiting for wisdom to arrive is just kind of a lazier version of pursuing wisdom as your whole life. It's not a solution, it's just depressing. So what do we do? If he's advocating against this life of pursuit, and we have all this time in our lives freed up from that impossible pursuit, right? If we've been pursuing all these things, chasing after a wind, chasing after vapor, chasing after the things listed as vanities, as hevel, as smoke, then what do we do? And the following two verses, 12 and 13, unpack how, in the context of what we have learned, we ought to live our lives. So we have to live our life unto him. The best life we can live, I've got that written up on the screen, is one that is lived according to his word, and to enjoy that life despite the seeming pointlessness of virtue. So that's the fancy way of saying, hey, it seems like we can't achieve it, we can't get it, and we have to sort of accept that before we can get closer. Sanctification is never completed in this life. And I think that that's a connection there of all this pursuit of wisdom and knowledge is kind of a pursuit of sanctification. It's that, well, I can become more like God. I can understand more. God is omniscient. I want to be omniscient because I want to be like God. Well, wanting to be like God is, I believe, what created, oh, right, the fall. So the preacher sort of finally reaches his practical advice, something he gives precious little of in the 12 chapters he's allotted in the book of Ecclesiastes. He starts off, I perceived that there is nothing better for them. This is hearkening back to the claim, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with in verse 10. We can thus understand what follows this phrase to be expanding on what followed that phrase. Conversationally, it reads like one statement building on the last, which is something we miss because I've been going so slow. So I'm going to reread it in that context, thinking of, I have seen the business, and then he explains what the business is. And then he says, there, I perceive that there is nothing better for them. And then he expands on the business. He says, I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. So, what is that? Then to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. That's the second half of verse 12. It's meant to build on that idea that everything is beautiful in its time, not our time, not the time that, you know, is convenient, but that thing's time, what God determines for it. So in the meantime, we're to live life joyfully and doing good. He says, look, we can't get that understanding on our own. God has to condescend for us to get that understanding. So in the meantime, while he isn't in the active moment of like giving us that, and while we're not in that sort of flow state of study where all of a sudden something makes sense, what are we supposed to do? Do we sit and despair that we don't get it because we're not going to get most of it? No. In the meantime, we live life joyfully. Do good. What's do good? Good's complicated. Well, I quoted Proverbs at the beginning of the message, Proverbs 2:20 through 22. And the beginning, he says, so you will walk in the way of the good and keep to the paths of the righteous. He's connecting to Proverbs. He's connecting to living wisely, one of the things that he says we can't grasp. He says, even though you can't achieve it on your own, you need to try, because God will lay out on the road ahead of you all of those wisdoms, all of those understandings, all of that moment when you do grasp through that hevel and you do understand that smoke. But if you're not moving down the road, you're never going to get there. It's not on any of your own strength that you reach it. But if you sit still and you don't do anything, nothing comes to you. He isn't quoting anything specific, so I'm not going to try to say that I'm connecting this perfect moment from Ecclesiastes 3 to Proverbs 2. I just chose a random proverb that said to do good because it served my purpose. I'm a terrible writer. I'm not going to lie to you about that. His statement is one of acceptance here. Despite the apparent hevel of living in any manner, he admits that the best life is one lived doing good up until death. And then verse 13 builds on this further. He says, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Everyone should eat and drink. We are to live life. It was later than it should have been last night when I made this connection. When Christ returns and he is standing in a house with some people and they're like, are you really Christ though? Because like we saw him die. They have him eat. Because eating, in the context that this is written in that culture, eating is a sign that you're not some apparition, you're not some ghost. We're to live life. We're to live a full life, a real life, a very, I keep wanting to say visceral, vivid life. We're here. We're alive. We should live. And then he says, take pleasure in all his toil. Again, the preacher doesn't contradict himself. He gives an answer seemingly not in keeping, because he's already said, you know, toil, why toil? Toil's pointless. All it is something that you make and you pass on and then it gets squandered. But maybe, again, taking a step back, looking at that passage about toil, it's vanity. It's a striving after the wind. It's a wind that eventually God will let us understand. We can't do it on our own, but eventually we will. Or maybe we won't. It doesn't really matter. We're supposed to live our life with the understanding that we can't understand. So he spent so much time leading up to this passage, talking about how the pleasure taken in toil, in work, and in life as a whole is hevel. It is smoke. It is vapor. But maybe that smoke isn't pointless. And the verse answers for us. The last line in verse 13, this is God's gift to man. Why would we chase after everything and get upset about what we don't have? I sound like I'm talking to a toddler. Instead of being grateful for what we do have. God has given us these things, and it is the best thing for us to live our lives according to his word and in his presence, looking and waiting for his spirit to come upon our hearts and impart some small drop of wisdom. At the beginning of the message, I said that the preacher seems to claim that only permanent things, right? Those sort of the things that are lasting into eternity, right? So toil isn't one of them. He actually doesn't list any because he can't find any. And he says that they're worthless, but that's not what he means.
it's true that alone in this world, there is very little meaning in anything. And a pursuit of understanding leads only to despair. But that is a life lived apart from God's infinite, and I mean infinite, generosity. A life lived within his love, however, is very different. In the final two verses of this passage, which serve in the context of the passage as a transition into the next section, the preacher makes some observations about God's work. I'd like to consider these in the context of God's greatest moment of the condescension we talked about in verse 11, when Christ came to live and die in this world as a man. He says, "I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor taken away from it. God has done it so that people fear before him." The salvific work of Christ is done. It is over. When the dying Christ calls out, "It is finished," that is final. Over. Nothing can be added to it. No extra sin that he forgot to cover, and nothing taken away. No sinner can out-sin God's mercy. We are eternal, but we are not infinite. God exists infinitely more than we do in our entire lives in one instant, because he is outside of time. He is forever in every direction. He is infinite, and his mercy is infinite. That verse, it's saying nothing can be added, nothing can be taken away. It's because it's final. What God does is done. And our sin does not stretch on for all of eternity. In fact, if we are saved, if we are believers, our sin stretches on right up until we die, and then sanctification is complete, and then there is no more sin. There is no sin in heaven and in what is beyond. Heaven, the new heaven, the new earth. Verse 15. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. God has seen everything. God is, like I said, outside of time, forever in every direction. He exists outside of time. He sees what will be and what has been, and even in the context of all our failures, of all of our sins, he forgives. But he doesn't just forgive, he does more than that. It's not just the difference of, you know, mercy and grace. Mercy, yes, he forgives. Grace, he extends something we don't deserve. That's sort of the bumper sticker phrase, you know, mercy is not getting something you deserve. Grace is getting something you don't deserve. God seeks that which has been driven away. And this one, I actually was very tempted to leave that clause off the end of my message, because as I was flipping through commentaries and such, most scholars don't really know what to do with the line. Because if you look in the following passage, 3:16 and on, it talks about oppression and people being oppressed and pushed down and held down. And really, God seeking what's been driven away is meant as a transition. It's meant to say, and now, hey, look, God seeks what's been driven away. Let's talk about that now. But I think there is a reason that it's part of that sentence. Because not only does God forgive us when we ask for forgiveness, God actively pursues even those who don't want his forgiveness. The sins that have been sinned already have happened. The sins which will be sinned already have happened. Even still, God pursues sinners. God pursues you and I to the ends of the earth and beyond them. God pursues the oppressed, and he pursues those oppressed by sin in the same way. Yes, Ecclesiastes might be talking about nations fleeing, and it also might be talking about people oppressed by any sort of mental issues they have, people oppressed by their own sin. God pursues everyone who is oppressed because God is merciful. God is gracious. And so my exhortation to you, sinner, is this. If you have not accepted the forgiveness with which God relentlessly pursues you, do so. He has done all of the work already and asks nothing of you. Start that life today. The only life truly worth living, because a life outside of his love is a life that is vanity. It is a striving after the wind. It is a chasing after a vapor we cannot grasp. And to you, believer, sinner, saved, forgiven sinner, seen as sinless in the eyes of God, live your life full of joy and good deeds. Take pleasure in your toil, and in all you do, do it for the Lord. Because this is the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Life lived according to his word. All your Bible plans probably have a Proverbs section. There's a reason for that. Thank you. We good?